Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Sarah McDooling, and I'm very lucky to be here today with the awesomely talented Mr. John Birmingham.
Thank you, Sarah.
John, you've written so many books across so many different types of genres, and this is something new, again, that you've done. Can you tell us a little bit about your new book?
Yeah, I can. It's called How to Be a Writer. And well, that's pretty much it, mate. You know, I think we're done.
It's called a bit more than that, though. It's got a pretty awesome subtitle. Do you mind if I read it out?
You knock yourself out.
So, How to Be a Writer Who Smashes Deadlines, Crushes Editors, and Lives in a Solid Gold Hovercraft. That last part is particularly of interest to me. How do I get myself a solid gold hovercraft?
Look, I'm embarrassed to admit that's actually marketing hype. The hovercraft is gold plated. Found with the solid gold model that it was too heavy, it couldn't hover at all.
So I'm crushed by this.
More of a craft.
Are you saying that a solid gold hovercraft is actually not within my grasp?
Not if you wanted to hover, no, I'm afraid not. Let's see, you're going to have to go for the gold plating, but you can get some pretty swish gold plating done.
All right, you know, I won't totally give up on the dream. So this is not so much a guide on how to write, but how to be a writer.
Yeah, I actually say in the first paragraph, my job isn't to make your writing, betterer and more awesome-tastic. I'm just assuming that people who are reading this book can put one word after another and, you know, not be absolute clowns about it.
The talent part is...
Yeah, I'm taking that as read. There are much better books by much better writers about how to write, but being a writer is a different... topic. I've done it now. I've paid my bills with it for an embarrassing amount of time. It's like nearly 25 years, I think, maybe even 30, coming up on 30 years as a writer. And I learned a lot of tricks of the trade along the way, particularly as a freelancer, where you're not on staff anywhere. Any dollar that you get in as a freelancer, you've had to hunt down on the tundra, kill with a stick and drag home yourself. And it was those kind of lessons that I wanted to pass on to people. It was going to be a self-publishing experiment. I've become quite interested in self-publishing the last 6 or 7 months. And over the years, people on Twitter and Facebook would ask me questions about, their writing and how they might, get a job here or a gig there or something published. And I usually, if it was an interesting question, I'd say, give me a day, I will write something on my blog and, just go and check it out. And over the years, I ended up accumulating maybe 30,000 words worth of advice to people. And it was all really practical stuff because, I am not the guy that you come to make your book more Tim Winton-like. I am the guy you come to if you've written a story for Playboy and they haven't paid up. I am the guy who will go get that money for you if you are my mate Pete.
You're also the guy who introduced me to the word awesome-tastic.
Yeah.
There's
one or two little writing tricks in there, but mostly it's about the biz and how you run the business. And I was going to throw these blog entries together as an experiment. I was kind of interested in how you publish a book yourself, an ebook, obviously. I wasn't going to bother with paper. And so I started to, gather them into something that looked like a manuscript and, wrote some extra bits and pieces here and there. And then Pip from New South was working with me on something else. I was writing an essay for a collection on copyright or something, similarly fascinating. And she said, is there anything else you want to do? And I mentioned that I had these blog posts that I was working on, and she, what can I say? She backed a truckload of money up to the front door and held a gun to my head and went, what was I to do, Sarah?
So, you had no choice.
Yeah, I ended up doing it for them, which is, so it's a much better book than it would have been if I'd done it myself, because they're pretty good. They know what they're about. So I sat down, wrote another 20,000 words worth of stuff. I asked people on Twitter, is there anything you'd like to know? And more questions came in, and I answered them, and eventually we had a book.
Well, it's a subject that is of interest to so many people, because I just feel like writing is something that so many people aspire to and struggle with, feeling that they're equipped to do it.
Yeah, I read the other day, like yesterday, I think that 80% of people want to write. and it's like a sickness with people. Everyone has a story. Not everyone has a book in them. Some people might only have an opening line, but everyone has a story at least. And most people are actually pretty good storytellers. You know, you might get trapped in a corner by some crushing bore at a party every now and then. But most people, if you just get them on whatever story or narrative it is that is driving them at the moment, will be able to entertain you for a little while with this story. And I guess that urge, that narrative urge, which is peculiarly human, it sits in all of us, and it's just an itch that people can't scratch, and they want to write. I've been pushing this book out for 2 or 3 days now, talking to people and giving lectures, and then people come up afterwards, they bought a copy and they sign it, and I always ask them, are you writing something? And they always are. I wrote the book with lots of jokes in it because I figured there'd be people who'd just read it for the lulls. But in fact, I think the people who've bought it would prefer if I just cut the lulls out and got to the point, Birmingham. They just want the advice because they want to write.
I don't know. I like the lulls. I have actually here in my notes a line that I looked down at just now and was a bit confused by, but it just says, be a poet, lol. So like... I don't want to give anyone any spoilers, but there is a chapter in the book about being a poet, and it's quite hilarious.
Well, it's very much on point, I think. I think I said everything I needed to say about being a poet in that chapter.
Succinctly.
Yeah.
I wondered, of all... throughout the book, you refer to young aspiring writers as baby writers.
Mm.
When you were a baby writer, and if you could choose one piece of advice out of this book... what would it be?
Out of this book, probably start early and give yourself like 30% more time than you think it's going to take to do the job. That's a very practical piece of advice which I'd give to anybody. And actually, I got that from a sports journalist. He wrote books as well, and his piece of advice was that if you think a book's going to take 8 months to write, give yourself, 9 or 10 or even a whole year, because stuff will come up and get in the way, and eventually you'll hit the panic button at the end. So just give yourself more time than you need to write. Oh, there you go. There's a piece of advice. Give yourself more time than you think you need to do this job, because it's going to take all the extra time. As a more general piece of advice, if you're writing, you're going to get told not to. You're going to be told you're an idiot, or you're just a hopeless dreamer, and you should really just get back to driving trucks for your country. Maybe you should be driving trucks for your country. Your country needs trucks, but yeah, don't give up on the writing just because people tell you it's hopeless. It's really not hopeless. You almost certainly are not going to be the next J.K. Rowling, but. There's no reason you can't write a book and put it out there and have some people enjoy it.
Someone had to be the next
J.K. Rowling. I'm sure when she was sitting in that grim Scottish cafe, nursing one cup of tea through, the long, cold winter of her discontent, that she did not realise she was going to be J.K. Rowling.
Exactly. You're out there. The next J.K. Rowling is out there somewhere and should perhaps be reading your book.
I don't know that J.K. Rowling needs your advice.
No, the next
one. The next one.
throughout the book, there's a lot of really great quotes from other writers and famous people. And I kept wanting to jot them down, and then I thought, well, I don't need to.
You got the book.
Yeah. do you have a favourite out of those, or one that you...
I do. I can't pull it out of my ear, but there is there's a quote about... first and second drafts, which I really do enjoy, because it's just, it's insane. It's just, I tell you what, you give me the book and I'll find it while, while I chat. If needs be, we can edit this bit out.
Hayley, who edits our podcast, is not going to like hearing that.
Never mind, Hayley. What do you think you're being paid for, mate? I'm keeping you in a job by sitting here flicking through this thing.
Be grateful.
I've been reading Damon Young's book on the art of reading.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's beautiful. It actually is really, really, really good. And here it is, Chuck Wendig. Yeah, but I, now that I'm on this Damon Young jag, I'm going to go with that as well. It's a fantastic book. It's the sort of book, he's a philosopher. He's also a black belt in karate, so I'm not going to say anything bad about him, but he has written this thing in that really, really dense way that philosophers write everything. There is an enormous amount of information and meaning packed into every line. But he's also, he writes for a popular audience, and so it's easy to read. But you end up going back and reading it two or three times anyway, simply because there is so much in there that you have to go through it a couple of times to read it. Yeah. Anyway, there's a great quote at the start of his, it's like the aphorism right in front of the book. It's from Jean-Paul Sartre, and the quote is just, "One does not write for slaves." It's a, there is so much packed into that one line.
Oh my
just
gosh.
Actually, like, you know, he internally shuddered when I read it. I thought, that's just so right. Anyway, but Chuck Wendig is not Jean-Paul Sartre. and this is one of my favourite quotes that I, you know, basically stole. He's talking about first drafts and second drafts. He's, it's going to get a little sweary. So, you know, if people get upset by that kind of thing, I suggest they fast forward by about 30 seconds. So much of writing a first draft feels like running a marathon while drunk. You're just galumphing about, yelling and laughing and crying and praying to sweet Saint Fuck that the end is near. And then in the end, you collapse in a puddle of your own liquor sweats. This man knows.
Well, that's awesome. Awesome-tastic, I might even say.
Better and awesome-tastic.
Humour is such a strong component in all of your books, regardless the genre. Do you have some favourite comedians, like, who might maybe influence you in your baby writer days?
In my baby writer days, definitely Hunter S. Thompson. Although Thompson wasn't trying to be funny, and he's often not funny, but he was a man who wrote about the absurdity of existence. And he mostly wrote about politics and power and, you know, the absurd relations that we have with modern power structures. And he could be funny without trying to be funny. I think it was a language thing with him. Some of the forms of language that he used were just so bizarre and just pulled the language out of its normal patterns and reformatted it in ways that were so striking that, you know, a natural human reaction was just to laugh at the audacity of it. But a writer who followed Thompson's path in many ways, although he came from the other direction, was P.J. O'Rourke. You know, Thompson was very radical and O'Rourke is very conservative. And he's a rare conservative who also has a sense of humour. And I very much enjoyed reading his Republican Party Reptile and just pulling it apart to see how it was that somebody with such conservative views could write such funny stuff, because it's very, very rare. And that's partly about, you know, the uses to which we put humour. It's not normally put towards the preservation of existing power structures. It's normally about relieving ourselves from them. But he's very good. Even though I don't agree with him politically, he's a really, really good writer and a great humorist. And just in terms of, you know, someone who can find really, really funny observations in quite stripped back and not emotionless and flat, but very restrained and reserved language is Louis C.K. He's fantastic.
That's a great combination there that you've got. I found that really interesting. I've never thought about the fact that I can't think of a single conservative comedian.
There's not many around. Fox tried to, Fox News in the US tried to have a conservative comedy show, and it was just such a train wreck that like even they gave up after a week to say, no, forget it, we can't do it. And it's partly because, you know, humans use humor to relieve stress, and it is like it's a medication for the soul, it's a balm for our hurts. And what conservative politics are about, without, you know, being sort of a gross lefty about it, they're about conserving existing power structures because they're valued. And so it's very, very difficult to mock people who aren't doing well out of the existing power structures, because you look like a complete jerk. And that's what the guys on that, you know, so-called conservative, you know, humour talk show on Fox look like, complete jerks.
Yeah.
To the point where even they recognised them, so they just gave up after a week. And that's the thing that makes O'Rourke so fascinating, is that, and I think it's his control of language that allows him to step around that yawning pit.
Yeah. I've never read any of his work.
I'll go read Republican Party Reptile. It is it's brilliant. It's one of the best books of commentary in the last 50 years.
Well, this brings me around to a question I wanted to ask you. There's a whole section in your book about reading more than you write.
Mm.
This question is twofold. A, why do you think... I've heard that so many times before, and intellectually I do understand why it's important, but I'd like to hear you explain why you think it's important. And B, what are you reading at the moment?
Okay. Well, I'm reading Damon Young's Art of Reading. in fact, I should have brought it with me. There is a paragraph that explains why you need to read if you are going to write. You can be a reader if you are not a writer. Most people are. You cannot be a writer if you don't read. A book gets written and published, but that is only half of its journey. It only really comes into being in the world when it's picked up by a reader and read, and then all of a sudden that magic happens, that transference of meaning from one mind to another, and that happens in the act of reading. Whole worlds are created, but they're created invisibly inside our head. And you cannot hope to master that very arcane magic if you do not understand the process of reading yourself, and if you do not read. You can't do it. You won't do it. There are no writers in the world, no successful writers, sorry, who do not read more than they write. And they don't necessarily read in their areas either. They will read widely outside them because, you know, all of existence can be contained within a book, and one of the quickest and easiest, most convenient ways of sampling all of existence is to read about it. It's very, very difficult to, it's impossible to go to, say, Paris in the 1930s and live as an indigent writer. You can't do it. You can't travel back in time. And even if you were in the 1930s, you probably couldn't, because you were poor and travel was really expensive, and you can't do it. But you can have that experience, that sort of mediated experience through reading down and out in Paris and London.
Yeah.
And so I'd say that I am surprised by the number of young writers I meet who want to write but say they don't have time for reading. But, you know, what they don't have time for is reading and Xbox and Netflix and hanging out. And there was always time for reading. And if you are a professional writer, you will actually make it. It's part of your job. Like, you actually get, effectively, you get paid to sit around on your butt reading books, articles or whatever. I don't know why people won't commit to it. But I do know that they won't be writers if they don't.
It is a thing that you hear a lot, that people who want to write are constantly saying, I just don't have the time. I could do it, but I don't have the time.
Mm.
And there's a section in your book about, swinging back to Hunter S. Thompson, actually, there's a whole section in your book about work routines, and he's is detailed in there, which was eye-opening. I mean, not that it's really eye, it's what you expect, but it's funny to read it.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a bit about your work routine?
Yeah, sure. It's pretty much stable now. I mean, it's changed a lot over the years, but now, like, I'm at home now. I'm not as interesting as I used to be because I got two teenage kids. So a lot of my existence is just being a suburban dad. And there's a lot of routine within that. So I do my writing within those constraints. I get up reasonably early in the morning because I married a morning person. And I spend the first couple of hours just wrangling kids out the door. And, anybody who's got kids will be familiar with, you know, what a fresh daily hell that is. So I get them off to school and, you know, hopefully they're dressed and have eaten. Then I try and get to my desk by 8 o'clock. I have a little alarm goes off on both my phone and my watch every day at 10 to 8. It says, you know, get to your desk now. And I try and get there at 8. And I start my Pomodoro. I use a time management technique called the Pomodoro method.
And I'd never heard of this before your book.
It's brilliant. Anybody who... this just isn't for writers. Like, anybody who's got stuff to do and is a hapless procrastinator, as all writers are, can benefit from this. It was developed by an Italian guy. He was a student, and he was hopeless. And, you know, he loved La Dolce Vita. He didn't like, you know, La Dolce studying very much.
Big on procrastination.
Yeah. And he was pretty close to basically bombing out. And he, in desperation, he's sitting at home one day in, you know, the kitchen. And he says to himself, I'm going to study for half an hour. If I can't study for half an hour, that's it. I'm giving up. I'm going to be a motor mechanic or something. And he didn't have a watch on him, but he's in his mum's kitchen, and he had one of those plastic tomato timers. You know, you sort of turn them and they tick, 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 tick for half an hour. Hence Pomodoro. It's Italian for tomato.
Oh, and that's where it comes from. Yeah. Okay.
And so, yeah, his name wasn't Mr. Pomodoro. Pomodoro timer. And in fact, if you get, like, there's now hundreds of Pomodoro apps you can put on phones and desktops, and they all have the little tomato timer app, or icon, sorry.
I'm never going to use the word kitchen timer again.
No, it's Pomodoro. anyway, he did it. It was the hardest half hour of his life. He just, you know, really, really hard. But he did it because it was only half an hour. And so he thought, oh, that's great. So, yeah, he then, I guess, went off and drank some wine and ate a breadstick and, you know, had a great time. He came back the next day and he did it again, and he built out of this not just a sort of time management technique, but a time management cult with, like, millions, literally millions of zombified cult followers, and I am one of them, around the world. And we organise our day in Pomodoro, or I guess Pomodori for the plural. So the idea is you work for 25 minutes and you take a 5 minute break. And in that 5 minute break, you step away from your computer. You do not read over what you've written. You have nothing to do with that work. I will often go and I have a little home gym next to my home office. And so in my 5 minutes, I'll often just go and do 5 minutes of very light exercise, something very physical, so I'm not thinking. Then I go back, you do another 25 minutes, 5 minute break. And you put four of those together. That's effectively 2 hours work. You get credit for your 5 minutes exercise. That's counted towards your work day. And then you can take a 15-20 minute break, which I normally do at about 10:15 in the morning. And I will go, I leave the office, I go upstairs. I normally have an iPad waiting for me upstairs, and I read a comic book on the iPad. You know, it's a very different type of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And usually most comics will take about 10 or 15 minutes to read. And then, you know, grab a cup of tea, go back down, and I just do that Pomodoro thing again. And that's 4 hours work, normally completed by about 1:30. And usually, to be honest, most writers are done after 4 hours. We're pretty lazy and and weak, and, you know, we can't work much longer than that, so it's over. Like, that's the day done. And I will, in the afternoon, you know, I might sort of, you know, do something on my blog, but I'll often read. That's when I'll get my reading done. If I have a newspaper column or something, I still have to write. I might do it in the afternoon. And then, of course, I've got the kids to pick up from about 3, 3.30, and then hours of wrangling them. So that is my work day. And that's pretty much every day, day in, day out. And it's very unglamorous and unromantic. But the thing is, if you do that, if you just commit to turning up every day, whether you feel like it or not, and doing the work, you will, even if you're not a professional writer, you will have the equivalent of a book after a couple of months.
But what about writer's block? Say you set your timer and you sit down and then there's just nothing.
Write something else, or come at it a different way. It's writer's block is sometimes not writer's block. Writer's block is it's a torture. You know, George Martin has it he admitted he had it with Winds of Winter.
Is that why we don't have it?
Well, yeah, partly because I feel a lot of sympathy for him, because he started writing this a long time ago, and when it was first published, it did not work. Like, it came out in the US and the UK, and it was very poorly handled by the publishers. They had terrible covers on it, and it was actually his Australian publisher who saved the series. It came out as some package of a bunch of titles that they picked up from head office, and I don't even know who the publisher is here, but someone in the office picked it up and read it. God, this is awesome, you know. But look at this wretched sinkhole of a cover, and we can do better than this.
Seeing those covers.
And so the Australian publisher designed a new cover, and it just, you know, in that weird way that these things do, it suddenly just lit a fire under this thing, and then that spread back to the US and the UK in the way that it will. So, but he was writing this series for a long time, obviously, before HBO got involved, and it was getting bigger and bigger, but it was getting bigger in the way the books get bigger. Like, you can be someone who sells 6 million copies of a book, and you can walk down the street in Manhattan and, you know, go from one end of the island to the other, and no one's going to recognize you because you are a writer. Everyone knows what George R. R. Martin looks like now, because he's the guy that does the Game of Thrones TV show. And there's a lot of hysteria and chaos that gets introduced into your life when you ascend to those levels of mass cultural awareness. And it will be very, very difficult for him to just sit down every day and do the work. And so I suspect that, you know, he just had just a storm of distraction and disruption fall on him a couple of years ago. And of course, as the deadline gets closer and closer, that sort of existential soul-eating panic begins to sink its teeth deeper into you. And eventually he just had to put out, you know, the statement he put out last year. He said, I can't do it. Everyone was thinking, you know, the TV series has caught up with him. What happens now? And he just had to admit he couldn't catch it. I'm not watching the TV series.
Really?
No, because, well, sorry, I've watched up until now.
But you'll wait.
But I want to read the books first.
Yeah.
And so I'm guessing that the books will diverge from the TV series, because, you know, they are separate media.
You can't help but wonder, like, because we know that he's given the people who make the show an outline.
Yeah.
So end game is probably
the same. But, you know, there are certain characters who live and who die in one form of the story, who may not live or die in the other form. So I want to read the book, and then I'll watch the series. But the other thing is, too, I don't have a Foxtel subscription, and I am just...
it's kind of easy to avoid them.
Yeah, well, I'm red hot. I'm not stealing people's IP. So although, you know, I could very easily watch it, I don't. And I will just wait until, you know, the book comes out and I've read that, and then I'll go buy the DVDs or something.
I admire your willpower. I can't help myself. But I do wonder, because I read the books a long while ago, before the show started, which I know is a thing people say, but, like, I read them around about the time that A Feast for Crows was published. A friend of mine was reading it and recommended the series, and so I had all of those books. And then there was a long wait for Dance with Dragons, and then we had the TV show.
Yeah.
And now I'm watching the new series, but I can't... I can't help but wonder, when the show comes before the books, what's going to be considered canon now, like, yeah, by most people?
Well, most people will watch the show. They, you know, I mean, the books sell lots and lots and lots of copies, but they don't match the ratings for the show, as far as I know. Like, probably more people steal the show in Australia than have ever bought the books.
And that's a byproduct of writer's block.
Yeah, we should
send him your book.
Yeah, so it's, look, writer's block, as I said, it does exist, and the reason I brought George up was that, you know, he admitted to having it, but a lot of time writer's block is actually not writer's block. It's, you know, boredom or disinterest or distraction. And, you know, there are various ways of dealing with it. I had a problem in my last series, the Dave Hooper series I was writing. I was writing from one point of view, Dave. I'd never done that before in a series. I'd always written from multiple points of view. And I found that I could not, understand what the other characters around him were thinking. I couldn't predict what they were going to do. I didn't understand their motivation. And it got to a point where it was actually very difficult to move forward in the story, because I didn't know what the other people on the page were up to, simply because I wasn't writing from within their point of view. And it brought me to a halt for about a week or so. And that wasn't writer's block. That was an inability to imagine what was going on with, you know, the other people on the page. And the way I dealt with it eventually was to write a couple of chapters from their point of view that were never going to be published. But it helped me understand what those characters were about. And actually, in the end, they did get published, because I just published them as standalone ebooks. And it's kind of interesting, like, there's a book called an ebook called The Protocol for Monsters, which effectively tells or retells the story of Emergence, but from the points of view of everybody around Dave. And you get a very, very different story. And that all grew out of not writer's block, but an inability to imagine what these characters might do, because I didn't understand them. And there are all sorts of instances where people have trouble putting words on the page that are technical fouls or blockages like that, but not actual writer's block, which I think is a form of depression and a sickness of the soul.
I love that idea of, if you get stuck, write a deleted scene or a little outtake that you don't intend to put in.
Write from someone else's point of view. Jump forward to, like, if you've done any kind of planning, if you know what's going to happen in the next chapter, just go write the next chapter. If you had a chapter you didn't like previously, go back and rewrite that. That might be enough to unjam the blockage. If you can't, then go do something else. You know, most writers will have a couple of different projects on. Sometimes going for a walk is enough. And just ask yourself, as you're walking around, what am I trying to say? And sometimes just keeping it as simple as that will unblock the process. Or do a different type of writing. You know, go off and write a blog post, or in my case, I'll often write a feature or a column or something. And just getting out of one particular headspace where I've become trapped, and into another one, particularly if it's media work, where, you know, they don't care about your, like, you know, precious feelings. They just want to copy when it's due, and that will get you moving.
Now, I haven't finished your book, because I just got my hands on my copy yesterday, but I noticed that there's a chapter right towards the end that I haven't reached yet that says write 10,000 words a day. I haven't read the chapter, so, I mean, is that actually possible?
It is possible. It's not recommended, but, I mean, not everyone who is getting this book is an actual writer. Like, some might be students, you know, doing a PhD or something like that. I tried to write it for more than just unpublished writers. Look, God knows, there's enough of them around. it is possible. I've done it. I don't recommend it. But it is, it's actually one of those things where, if you find yourself, you know, thinking you're a bit blocked, rather than trying to, you know, nut out the impossible Gordian knot of the next, you know, line or paragraph, maybe you should just commit to writing 10,000 words. And there are ways of doing that, which I, you know, sort of talk through in the book. And it is, I've done it occasionally with books, not so much because I was behind on a deadline, but because I just found myself getting a bit bogged down. And sometimes, I remember Rod Marsh, the former test cricketer, he was a good batsman, but he had a terrible slump with the bat. And he was in England on an Ashes tour, and you know, he was getting out so much that, you know, everyone was just waiting for him to get out. Anyway, he went out to the middle, apparently really, really angry, and he didn't think about form or technique or anything. He just threw the bat as hard as he could at the ball and like smashed a very fast 50. And it was partly luck, and partly just constrained violence. And he hit himself back into form, which is a phrase you'll hear cricketers in particular use. And it's possible for writers to hit themselves back into form as well with a short, concentrated, violent burst of writing.
Wow.
And it doesn't have to be beautiful. In fact, it's not going to be 10,000 words a day. It's not a chance. But at the end of the day, you are so much further along in your story that it can really pick you up and carry you forward. That just the momentum of having written that many words will carry you through another week worth of, you know, more considered scribbling.
Well, John, thank you so much for coming in today. It's been a pleasure to meet you and talk to you.
Thank you.
And podcast listeners, How to Be a Writer Who Smashes Deadlines, Crushes Editors, and Lives in a Solid Gold Hovercraft, or possibly just gold plated.
Gold plated.
Is available from Booktopia now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.